What do you get when three comic and entertainment enthusiasts join together to discuss the topics that interest us all? Something that is truly larger than life. What's on the page?
On the screen.
And on our minds. Is front and center here on Larger Than Life with Dan Totora and co-hosts TJ Yeldon and Brian Yeldon.
Welcome here to Larger Than Life with Dan Totora here on LargerThanLifeDT.com and the downloadable app that you can get by going to LargerThanLifeDT.podbean.com/mobile. We've been honored to have a lot of different voices on this show, people who have voiced characters, created characters in some way, shape, or form. And to me, this is a special one, and not that the others don't all have their own merit and their own piece of what was special about each of them, but I grew up a Darkwing Duck fan, and I was a fan from day one, still a fan, still have the picture of my Darkwing Duck watch, and still have my Darkwing Duck watch, and I truly, the one that opens with his cape and showing you the time from when I was a kid, and I remember my third grade class picture because of it, and it's because of people like Tad Stones that have created these characters that we've come to know and love and respect and appreciate, such as Darkwing Duck. So I'm very honored and I'm very privileged to for the child in me to be able to proudly announce Tad Stones to the show. Tad, how you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing good.
Now,
just over a cold, so forgive me if my voice cracks or drops or goes away entirely.
Well, no worries about that whatsoever. The important thing is that we all kind of weather this fall into the winter, as we unfortunately have to do. So.
Yeah.
Ted, I want to start at the beginning for you. What your inspirations were, you know, as a child, what kind of drew you to the world that you're in today? Some of those initial moments where you felt like, hey, you know what, maybe this is something I want to do.
I was literally born across the street from Walt Disney Studios at St. Joseph Hospital in Burbank. So maybe that had something to do with it. But from the very earliest memories, I was always drawing. My dad had wanted to be a cartoonist, but he got out of college in the recession. It was more about getting any job you can get than following a dream. But he was always drawing. He was always cartooning. And the coolest thing for me is he had all these art books, and among them the famous cartoonist course, which was Milt Caniff and Rube Goldberg and Harry Higginson, Al Capp, just these fantastic, you know, artists. And it was just had a cartoon. So that was always part of my library. So that had an influence on me, but I just always enjoyed cartoons. My age is appropriate, I believe, when Rough and Ready, which was Hanna-Barbera's first cartoon, first to be made for TV too, came on the air. Loved that. Loved Crusader Rabbit, which I believe was Jay Ward's first cartoon. So I also loved Mighty Mouse, except for the opera stuff. Here I come to save the day. But I graduated Mighty Mouse to Superman, and although the earliest comics I saw were, you know, Little Dot and Hot Stuff, and well, my favorites were Casper, but even more than him, Spooky and Hot Stuff. So I was always drawn to the more mischievous characters. And then graduated to mostly DC superheroes in the Silver Age, which was fantastic. That's when it was all about these big, wild, crazy visuals and crazy ideas. There wasn't any sort of accent on continuity. So it was all about how crazy a story can you do. Meanwhile, over in animation, my dad worked for Carnation Company, which had an affiliation with Disneyland. And so the company picnic every year was at Disneyland. And they used to have an art of animation exhibit that was a walkthrough. and I got the Bob Thomas Art of Animation book, which broke to use Sleeping Beauty as an excuse to tell the story of how animation is done. Later, Don Hahn did like two versions of a similar book. Anyway, that, so it was always there. I always was fascinated by the Disneyland shows that showed Walt going behind the scenes, talking to animators, talking to Ward Kimball, who I ended up working with. So all that, the earliest stuff is the hodgepodge of I enjoyed science fiction and fantasy. I don't think any one thing steered me toward it. Those were the things that I was most enthusiastic about. And then about the time normally you would give up comics, back then anyway, my family went on vacation, and I went to the general store of the camping ground, and they had these comics with little character boxes in the corner, and I had never seen those before. And I picked one up, and it was Tales of Suspense. And it was Iron Man versus the Melter. And that was the first Marvel comic I got. At the same time, there was Tales to Astonish, I'm going to say 49, which was the comic where Ant-Man first became Giant Man. And I couldn't put my finger on it, but they felt different. There was something about the comics. And I went back and bought all the comics that were, had the little box in the corner. And as we drove over, it was at Lake Tahoe. As we drove around the lake, anywhere that had comics, I would check out the racks to see if there were any more. And that started my collection of Marvel comics. I went back home and got everybody in the neighborhood hooked on them. And, for a long while, wanted to get into comic books. Which I've done here and there, I was just looking up what number Tales of Suspense Iron Man versus the Melter was. It's too small to see. Oh, there it is, number 47, Tales of Suspense 47. Yeah. My first glimpse of Marvel Comics. And anyway, that what they did is brought personality to comic books. What Disney does in animation is bring personality to the end. I mean, that's what he was famous for. Before Walt, there was, the guys doing Felix the Cat had a real strong personality. But when I was doing my shows, it was all about the characters, not as big a concept as Darkwing Duck may have been in superhero terms. It was still all about character and character humor. Animation comics were always in my bloodstream, and when I dated my current wife in college, her suite mate said, "You ought to, you should apply to Disney." And I go, "Well, yeah," but my feeling was Disney, was the only place worth working in animation, and they had their animators. And that was actually pretty true up until about the time, I'd say my mid years in college is when they were starting a training program. That girl's father was Ex Atencio, who was a famous layout man and worked with Ward on Kimball on the space projects. Then went to Imagineering, worked in Pirates of the Caribbean and all sorts of rides there. They put me in touch with the guy who, the name the guy should call to find out about the training program, because I was a senior trying to figure out what I was going to do. I called to find out information. He assumed I was calling for an appointment to bring in my portfolio, so when it was scheduled, the only problem with that, I hadn't been an art major since my sophomore year because all my English teachers wanted me to write. I switched majors to humanities, which seemed like a chance to do both. I somehow ended up taking more 3D art like sculpture and became a TA in ceramics. I never did like painting. So, I didn't have a portfolio. Luckily, my ceramics teacher took over the art department that year because the head of the art department went on sabbatical. And he said, oh, you can sit in on the lecturing classes, whatever you need to build up a portfolio. So it was just crazy that worked out. I submitted it and then got into the program. And then you do basically as you're learning animation, you're doing a little test, which Don Bluth once described as learning to play an instrument and then at the same time being asked to play in the band. But I knew a lot about animation from all my study over the years. I came in about 4 months after Ron Clemens and about 2 or 3 months before Glenn Keane. So those were my guys. Ron, of course, currently director of Moana. Anyway, that's a very long-winded answer. But to say those are a lot of my influences is that's how I got to Disney. And then within Disney, I realized I was more interested in figuring out what the characters did than actually making them do it. And eventually I got to the newly created Department of TV Animation. And I was one of the founding fathers of that, I guess. You know, my career at Disney was fun because my job changed every year and a half, 2 years. And then when I got to TV, my show changed about that often. So.
And speaking here with Ted Stones, Ted, when you look at that, like you said, one of the founding fathers in a way of, you know, when you look at TV animation, when you look back upon that, what does that mean to you? You know, Darkwing Duck, Rescue Rangers, and so on and so forth. When you look back on history and you hear people like myself, you know, just turned 31, and that was my era. You know, I grew up on Rescue Rangers and DuckTales and Darkwing Duck and you know, all of those. And those are the things that, you know, we always say, or at least the people in my generation that I know of always say, those were the good old days. You know, that's when cartoons were great. That's when they had a great story. And you know, those are the things that we kind of yearn for again to this day. To be one of the founding fathers, so to speak, what does that mean to you? And what have you seen over time from people that were connected to some of these characters that you helped bring to life?
Well, yeah, I was in the first meeting that Michael Eisner held, which was at the end of his first week at Disney. He had this meeting about TV animation, about getting into it. I was one of the, you know, 10 people or so there, which was practically a fluke, but I'd worked with the people who were, you know, previously on projects, and they appreciated my input. And then about 9 months later, I moved over to the division because I was actually thinking of leaving the company. But they said, no, come over and see us over here. And, you know, kind of was a whirlwind thing, and I ended up there. So I was about, they had been literally underway for 9 months. But as far as the shows, a lot of that credit goes to Gary Kreisel, who is the guy who put the department together, pulled everybody together. And his right-hand man was Jim Magon, at least in the very early years. Gary ran the record company. He had gone to college with Jim. And, you know, at the record company, they'd come up with ideas for albums, kind of in the Weird Al Yankovic vein, that the record company had done nothing, and they started out putting out, you know, novelty records with, you know, Goofy and Donald and all of that, or just joke records with Willie Onfilio, Will Finn, who does many an animated voice, Will Ryan, I should say, sorry. Now I'm questioning my brain, which, always fact check. anyway, that was they were just had creative energy, and they brought that to TV animation, and they were very much in the Disney tradition vein of, you know, you tell stories with heart. No matter how funny you make them, you know, you're kind of, you know, not every show is the same. The first two shows they did were Wuzzles and the Gummy Bears. Wuzzles was kind of a co-production, I think, with Hasbro. and because they had both come up with similar ideas at the same time. And that was more joke-oriented. That was on CBS, and Gummy Bears won at NBC. And that was Jim Magon and Art Vitello really created that show together. And to me, it really was, you know, especially when they were allowed to do 22-minute episodes, you know, started to have a more of a Disney feel there. Anyway, when I came on, you know, I was following that tradition. I gave notes as best I could. I took over the third season of Gummy Bears. Chip and Dale is a huge favorite for many people. We were drastically understaffed, especially in the story editing area, because it was just myself and Bryce Malick. And we had three teams of artists who needed work. We didn't know what we were doing, so it was just two of us trying to feed that with some staff writers, a lot of freelancers. And it led to a lot of hours, way too many. And then, you know, to compare, normally you have one more story editor than you have production teams. So we were definitely working at a deficit. Anyway, you know, I would get scripts in and rewrite Act 1 and then write the Act 3. So a lot of, you know, scripts were actually co-written by me. But, you know, the staff was great. Had a lot of energy to it and fed us. Bruce Talkington, who is basically the model for Professor Nimnol, Julia Leewald, and Dev Ross, and Len Yulee, and I can't keep naming people because I always forget somebody. Anyway, it was just a fun time, and we were trying to do the best we could. With Darkwing, I felt like had a little bit of a breather and said, okay, my goal is to, one, do a show that's more me, to get more of the humor through, because I felt like with Rescue Rangers, sometimes things got lost because we were stretched so thin, we couldn't follow up. People didn't understand what we were going for. And I'm talking in small ways, but it's still, when you're doing a comedy, it's, you know, every little bit helps. With Darkwing, you know, I felt like, okay, I want to take short subjects, make them 22 minutes long, and add heart to it. And I think, you know, some of our shows are brilliant and others are just okay. But on the whole, you know, what I really, my favorite character was Goslin. And the heart of it was Goslin and her father, Darkwing. I've had women break down in tears in front of me at conventions because evidently, sadly, they had a very terrible family life. And Darkwing and Goslin gave them some, it was just a touchstone. It was, you know, something that gave them the sense of family that they were missing. And we were just trying to be funny. I had a great convention in Maui and a fan flew from Italy to be there. To meet us, and by us I meant myself and Aaron Sparrow, who writes the Darkwing comic book, and James Silvani, who is the artist, and we were just blown away. Now, the fact that she had a vacation in Maui may have had a little bit to do with it, but she did come because we were there. So that, when you're doing the show, you get told whether it's successful or not, because what people don't understand back then with the Disney Afternoon, the number of episodes had nothing to do with ratings. It was just various business decisions. we got to do more Dark Wings because ABC wanted more episodes to air that were different from the ones airing in syndication. We enjoyed what we were doing. And, you know, trying to keep it fresh, but it really affected the audience. We were told, yes, it's successful, but you don't, it's not like you're in a theater watching a play that you've written and you hear how the audience reacts, or even a, you know, in a movie theater. So it's years later you find out what people were thinking, you know, which is great.
When you have that opportunity to find out, you know, like you said, years later, what people were thinking, how they were reacting to these characters and to their stories and to what they're all about. Are you surprised at all by how people respond to you when it comes to the Rescue Rangers, the Fox and the Hound, to, you know, obviously the Adventures of the Gummy Bears, Aladdin, Buzz Lightyear, and Darkwing Duck? When people come up to you and they tell you, I mean, to this day, at 31 years old, I still, you know, look around for Darkwing Duck t-shirts. I look for pen, you know, anything I can find, a pen, a pin, whatever that they have, because to me, it's such a big part of my life. He was my favorite character that was off the beaten path of Disney, so to speak. And, you know, he's still a character that is top of the mind for me. And we're talking, you know, more than 15 years ago when I'm first around this character. So when people come up to you and they share that with you that, you know, hey, I'm whatever, you know, 40 years old, 50 years old, 30 years old, and I still think about this character all the time, or is he ever going to come back to television? Are they ever going to come back to this, that, and the other? To have that, how do you respond to it as a creator to know that what you were doing late at night, sitting there at creating, producing, writing, drawing, whatever it may be, that work that you were doing late night in a studio is still at the top of the mind of so many people?
Well, at first I was just totally amazed and blown away. So now I've come to accept that. I'm still super appreciative of the reactions. And, I love that, you know, in a lot of cases they were inspired to do stuff on their own or draw, or, you know, it just affected their sense of humor, hopefully in a good way. I just marvel at it. And, you know, I once had a woman sing the entire theme song of Chippendale's Rescue Rangers in front of me, and she had this great, you know, gospel choir type voice and just belted it out. And what was great is Jim Cummings walks up behind her, is listening to her, and then compliments her in the voice of Monterey Jack. Of course, Jim did the voice of Monty and Fat Cat and half the villains in Rescue Rangers, and of course Darkwing Duck himself.
And when you have people around you like James Sylvania and Jim Cummings and other people that you have mentioned, what have you taken away from those that have surrounded you? Have they called out you to be your best self? Have they brought out truly, you know, the best in you, things in you maybe that you thought weren't there, or maybe things, places that you thought you couldn't get to? Was your team always a team that challenged you and pushed you to be the best you can be?
Well, Aaron and James are the modern caretakers, at least for the rest of the year,
yeah,
of Darkwing, because they do the comics.
Right.
So they were fans. James was particularly a fan of DuckTales and then came to appreciate Darkwing. Aaron, you know, lived and breathed Darkwing, and still does. And he's done a remarkable job of capturing the feeling of the show. The only thing, when he was the editor at Boom Studios that did the first modern run of Darkwing, the only thing I was critical of at all, as I said, again, the show is about, you know, Drake Mallard and his daughter, that we didn't sell it internally until we had the conceit, what if Batman had a little girl who refused to stay at home? That's the heart of the show, and they had split them up in their storyline. I said, don't do that. Put them back together. She's the obstacle sometimes because of her enthusiasm. He messes up sometimes because he's worried too much about her, or he's reacting against her, obviously because of his ego. But I said, they're more of a team than Darkwing and Launchpad. so they've done fantastic. As far as the team I did the show with, yeah, I mean, the story editors were a fantastic bunch. When I talk about my favorite villains, one being Megavolt, voiced by Dan Castellaneta, did such a fantastic job. But especially as written by Doug Langdale, who just had this crazy way of writing for the villain and coming up with things that I just would marvel at. The one I always quote is, he had Megavolt rob a jewelry store, but instead of robbing jewels, he steals the light bulbs from out of the display cases. Now that I could have come up with. Anyway, what I couldn't have come up with is Megavolt grabbing the bulbs in his arms, rushing out to the sidewalk, and then flinging them out, saying, "Be free, my children." And of course, all the bulbs break on the sidewalk, and he just slumps in sadness. That's a special kind of genius. And of course, on the voice side, Jim Cummings has often said Tad Stones is the father of Darkwing, but the mother of Darkwing is Ginny McSwain. Ginny was both, cast a lot of the, the main cast, all the voices as we went through, and she was the voice director, and really, she fed back to James things that he had done in previous episodes, and together they built the character of Darkwing Duck. And all the artists, I had Mike Peraza is a fantastic concept artist, and he was at TV Animation at the time, and he was on Darkwing before it was actually a show, but really drew the and designed the Audubon Bay Bridge and his interior of his headquarters. In fact, looking at it now, it's always like, oh, we should have gone back and used that and used this. But you go with the stories that you have at the time.
Speaking here with Tad Stones, Tad, when you look back at all this time and you look back at all these people that you've mentioned so far and everything that inspired you, everybody that helped you get to this point, everything you have inside of yourself to get to this point, when you look at adversity maybe along the way, where did you find that adversity from? Either at home, either in work or whatnot, but where would you say maybe some adversity came from, some walls came from, and how did you jump over those? Because on Larger Than Life with Dan Tortora and in everything I do, I think it's important to let people know out there that adversity hits us all and it's how you respond to it. So how did you respond to it?
Oh, sometimes great and sometimes not well. At the end of Rescue Rangers, I was actually pulled off the show. And this is a show that I had been working on, 7 days a week. My day off was Sunday because I only worked 4 hours, and Saturdays only 8 hours. and then I was pulled off, because they thought the show was coming out too young. And as my story editor partner said, we're doing a story about 3-inch-high chipmunks. It's going to be young. But it was pulled off, and my team wasn't treated respectfully. I didn't think so. And I really felt like this isn't for me. I've given so much, and I felt I was being treated terribly. And, I have to say, many people at the time thought the same. One of the silliest things that kept me going was I was so close to my, 15-year anniversary. And this is a very silly thing, but Disney, and I assume they still do, gave out little plaques and statues at various points in time. And at 15 years, you get a Mickey Mouse Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yep.
Bronze, and it was the old, to my feeling, much better sculpture. And I was so close to it. I was like months away. I thought, I should stay for that. And the boss reached out to me. He knew how angry I was. I was fine with the decision at first, because we had written the pilot under, and we didn't have enough time to write it. We said we need more time to do this. And we actually ended up writing, and when I say the pilot, it's not the first thing written, it's the what the audience will see first, the multi-parter. We had to write it in less time than usual, which made no sense to me. So it wasn't the best thing we had done, but we, you know, when I was pulled off the show, I said, well, I've done this many episodes. I got to do the opening story. I'm fine. I'll take the break. But it was the day I found out that they were going back in and tearing up the pilot and rewriting drastically and stuff like that. That was kind of like the last straw. But a lot of that might have been exhaustion. And at the end of the day, it's such a creative job. You know, the boss reached out to me, kind of calmed me down. And I forget what I came back to do immediately or whether I just took a vacation, whatever. But that basically led to me developing Darkwing Duck in a lot of ways. So if I hadn't had that space and that time and that distance. So that was one of the things. Other than that, adversity is just, for me, it was always the schedule on all my projects. I consider my career highlights to be Darkwing Duck and my Hellboy movies that I did. I did two animated Hellboy movies. And sadly, they were also rushed. The scripts overlapped in development. I was told that they had to cut a week out of my script schedule, like on my third day there. And it was like, because I was new there, I didn't challenge it. But I'm thinking, you're cutting down the script schedule of the script that I don't even have a premise for yet? I mean, it's that whole, you know, bean counter kind of view of looking at things. Well, we'll make it work by just changing the time, as opposed to maybe we shouldn't move forward till we actually have a story everybody agrees on. You know? But that was still one of the most creative times. I got to tell a whole different type of stories, but those, you know, those two movies had to overlap in production. Then we got a chance to write a third one that was, you know, much stronger, using everything we had learned. And by then, the company had sold to somebody else, and we never got to produce the third one. So, you know, Hollywood is always, you know, throwing up disappointments and things like that. You just, you know, look for the next project. But what I get most of my energy from, or did in my career, was working with a staff of people much more talented than I am in any particular area. I always said I knew enough to be dangerous about each job. I was not a painter, but in working with the painters and seeing their techniques and talking about it, I could then give a later guy, you know, some, you know, good notes that made him understand what I was looking for. You know, and like I talked about Doug Langdale, who went on to do Dave the Barbarian and Earthworm Jim and The Weekenders, and, you know, is doing Puss in Boots right now at DreamWorks. It's just, I love seeing that, you know, thing I could never think of, you know, suddenly appear in my show. And then, of course, the voice acting. When you hear these guys really, you know, Jim Cummings take a script for Darkwing Duck and turn it into a living, breathing character, it's fantastic. Of course, he adds to it too, and not just coming up with new lines or something, just saying a line in a different way or giving it a different kind of energy. You just, you know, you look for support in the creative energy of those around you, and if you're respecting them and they respect you, it's fantastic. And I always try to protect my crew from management going on whenever they rear their ugly heads. So it's all good.
Before I let you go, Tad, to look at Darkwing Duck specifically, and I know you've talked about a bunch of different characters and Hellboy as well, I kind of want to, as a two-part question, Darkwing Duck, what brought him to reality? What created him in your imagination? And then in the respect of Hellboy, to live in that world that is a lot darker than Disney, obviously. So, you know, first part, what brought Darkwing Duck to life? What really were the ingredients that created such a character? And then secondly, what made you want to tell a totally different story with Hellboy?
Darkwing, I was ordered to do a show by Jeffrey Katzenberg, who then left Disney and, you know, created DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen. We had done an episode of DuckTales called 00 Ducks, one Pat McQuack is a James Bond parody. And at the time, Jeffrey and Michael both were very oriented toward titles because they expect you to do a strong show. They expect you to do, you know, a quality show. But they're still looking for a little extra edge when it came to selling the show and getting it out there in the marketplace. For instance, I once pitched a show called Miami Mice. They immediately loved it. And someone said, well, how can we do that? They're going to do jug. You know, they can't do drugs. And he said, well, they'll do cheese. And we actually, I did a, you know, a script with Carl Gears, who went on to do the Winnie the Pooh show. And that's where the character Fat Cat came from. You know, anyway, it was just the name Miami Vice, then turned into Metro Mice, and kind of started steering us toward Rescue Rangers. Anyway, Jeffrey had this idea that 00 Duck was a character that just the name sounded silly, funny, and obviously suggested a genre that would cut through the marketplace. I thought that it was just, you know, this is before Austin Powers, and I felt like, well, it's just going to be a spy parody. It doesn't have a sense of family or Disney heart. But I went in and did all the typical, you know, James Bond type things, which were all uninspired because I was uninspired. Anyway, I pitched it to Jeffrey, and he said, this is just a James Bond parody. It doesn't have any sense of family or Disney heart. Do it over. Which I'm happy I got the chance to do it over as just being thrown off of it. Anyway, then I had to do what I should have done the first place, which is, okay, how do I make this secret agent a more fun kind of guy? And I started thinking of the old pulp classics. Actually, Doc Savage is not one we talk about a lot. We always talk about Green Hornet and The Shadow, which are obvious parallels with Darkwing. But Doc Savage used to have a team of experts that would work with him. So I at the time, thought that might be a chance to bring in something to use that you know, it's a group of guys, even though one guy is the head guy. Then more people got put on it, and just to brainstorm using the writers and our editors around, and getting some art done by Bob Klein at the time, and then Mike Peraza later on. Anyway, so it was the pulps, and it was my love of those Silver Age comics. Now, because the internet didn't exist, and I had all my old Marvel comics, very few DC comics, but I could half remember wonderful covers drawn by Carmen Infantino of The Flash, where, like, they had the best concept covers. Here's Flash with an old man's beard. Here's Flash as a, you know, 500-pound runner. You know, here he is with a super evolved head. Here's Jimmy Olsen with a turned into a giant turtle boy. Here's Lois Lane with a super evolved giant head. Here's Superman. They would reuse things. I used to tell my jumping ahead. I used to tell my story editors, pitch me the comic book cover. That way, we always have a visual at the heart of the show that makes it right for animation. Anyway, all those aspects, I said, this is a chance to do, given this really cool rogues gallery of villains. Anyway, as I mentioned before, what really made it work was the idea of there's this little girl who refuses to stay at home. Launchpad McQuack, even though he was in the original 00 episode, was not part of the show until we realized we got way too many characters here. Let's winnow them down. We really need, you know, one guy, one sidekick. And Launchpad was around. You know, he was like an actor out of work. So I was like, hey, why not? And he worked great off Darkwing's ego, 00 Duck's ego. Anyway, got a go-ahead from Jeffrey. free, sold the show, and found out we didn't have the rights to the words Double O Duck, you know, so we need a new name. And had a contest, and the winner was Alan Burnett, fantastic writer and story editor, who came up with the name Darkwing. I loved it immediately, had never thought of Nightwing, but I said, let's put Duck on it, so that has the adventure and the silliness that I won the character. Alan got $500, and left to Warner Brothers to create the first, well, and I stayed with Warner's ever since then, went over with, you know, to help Bruce Timm create the original Batman animated series. So I always joke that, you know, we kind of warmed him up with Darkwing, even though all he did was name the character. So that's where he came from. And then as soon as it was a relief to lose the name, because then I got to play more to what I loved, which the secret agent side was still part of it, but he became much more of a shadow Batman kind of thing. And he grew as a character by recognizing what was funny and putting it back into the show. So Darkwing, I always wanted him to say something like the Shadow. So he said, I am tearing the flaps in the night. I cannot remember, probably have a script in a box somewhere that tells me what the second line used to be. It was like the third episode that was in work, at least very early on, that the premise was that Launchpad was mistaken for Darkwing or whatever. Launchpad had to masquerade as Darkwing, but he could never get the lines right. So he said, I am the rust that, or I am the road salt that rusts the underside of your car. And he kept messing it up, and we thought it was hilarious. That was not my idea. That was, you know, whoever came up with those. But I said, we have to give that trait to Darkwing. Let's go back, add it into the scripts we already have done, all the ones we have in work. Every episode, he has to say, let's get dangerous. And he has to have a new phrase. So that was the idea of recognizing, again, the talents and people around me, the power of a great idea and putting it back in. The other one was Negaduck. The original episode that was Negaduck is Megavolt split Darkwing into a good and a bad version. And we love the bad version. And I said, I want to repeat that villain. Let's bring him back. And the story editors at first said, how do we do that? Because then we're stuck with the good Darkwing, who is kind of boring. and it would be the same story over and over again. I said, no, I'm not saying bring back Positduck. Just bring back Negaduck. And I said, don't explain it. Just do it. And that's created one of Darkwing's favorite villains for many people. And, you know, we eventually got around to saying, oh, there's a Negaverse that he comes from. But, you know, give us more time, he would have had a third origin. I think Darkwing had four or five in the course of the show. So anyway, that's kind of where he came from. With Hellboy, I loved Mike Mignola's Hellboy comics as soon as they came out. I actually pitched it at Disney, which did not go, which is probably a good thing. No one wants to see Heckboy on the main street posing with Mickey, Donald and Mickey. Although it'd be very surrealistic. Anyway, I pitched it, didn't go. I always wanted to do it. When I left Disney, I needed sample scripts, and by then I had worked with Mike Mignola on an Atlantis show that sadly got canceled in mid-production. Everybody really enjoyed it, and I was doing that show with the idea of, I'm never going to get to do Hellboy, so this is my X-Files paranormal show. And then I was out the door at Disney, and I worked with Mike just to, I wanted to say, I want to do a couple of half-hour sample scripts using Hellboy. And he gave me notes on them. It was very generous of him, because it wasn't like leading to anything. But that ended up, when the live-action movie was in the works, they wanted to do a cartoon series. My name was right there in the forefront, you know, so because of Mike, and because actually my agent was handling the Hellboy licensing. which is why he became my agent. So I always loved the character, and the attraction there was to use animation as a medium to tell a different kind of story that was still family friendly. There's nothing wrong with the entire family being entertained by something, but make it spooky and scary, not Scooby-Doo scary where you just say, oh, it's a haunted house. No, you take the time to prove that it's a haunted house, like you would in a modern horror film.
Yeah.
I so wish we had gotten it. Originally, we would have done a series of... I mean, originally it was supposed to be a series on Cartoon Network. They couldn't make the deal. Became a series of DVDs. We thought could be like 7 of them at least. And then, like I said, the company got sold. The new owners decided, no, we don't want to spend our own money on this. And we kind of messed up the release of it in the first place. But I love working in those things. I wish I could do more.
And what keeps you going today? I mean, do you still come up with ideas? Do you still have pieces that are yet to be done? Do you still have characters that you have in your brain that you want to put on paper and put on TV to animate them and whatnot? Where do you kind of stand today? Do you sit back and kind of take in everything that you've created over time, or are you still constantly back to the drawing board, back to thinking of something new and different?
Well, actually, I'm retired now. I retired at the beginning of last summer. And the last show I did debuted on Netflix. It was a Netflix original called Koolapari, an Army of Frogs. And that was based on a series of books by Trevor Price. So that was, I had a great time on that show, specifically because of the animation crew in Nova Scotia from Cartoon Conrad Studios. It was so great working with them because it was like a throwback to my feature days because of the setup they were doing. Even though it was mostly done in Flash, there was a lot of hand-drawn animation to the process. And I got to see Russ, so I could kind of give notes on a scene as it's being developed, and that was just came out so much better than I expected it to begin with. So that was a fun one to go out on. It was not my show in that, I rewrote scripts heavily, but it wasn't my story. I was following the stories of, you know, Trevor's stories that were in the books. I still had, at the time, a show that Amazon was a little bit interested in, but then I had gotten my Netflix job, so I didn't get back to them. So I look back over it, and it's like, man, I don't want to. This is a really fun group of characters. I want to tell all sorts of different stories. I don't really want people to, tell me how to do that. And Amazon, I retired a year early than planned. I'm 64. And that part of that was financial reasons. I'm very lucky because of all those years at Disney and working on animated projects with Union Studios. I'm in a nice position with my pension. So it made sense to actually retire early, but what it'll let me do is take some of those ideas, and now I'd like to develop them as comics. I don't have to sell it because I'm not looking to replace my career in animation with a lower-paying career in comics. But these days, I could just publish a page a week if I want. It's just about, hey, here's what I'm doing. I'm putting it out there, and maybe I'll collect it into a book. Then I have a book to sell at conventions. That would be great. I have publishers that say, no, anything you come up with, we want to see. But, yes, I have a track record of, entertaining stories. But, why wouldn't you say that? Say, sure, show it to me. There's no downside to getting to be the first one to see something. Anyway, I do have stories to tell, so that's my plan. My challenge right now is, if this was my livelihood, I would have to be rigid about, you know, every day having to work on it. I am supposed to be retired, so I'm kind of juggling my time to, I want to work on it, but then I'm invited to this convention. I need to do original art for the convention because since I have nothing but Disney characters, that are the most popular, Darkwing and Rescue Rangers specifically, it's like I don't own those, so I can't really make prints of those, or at least not legally. So that takes me off my work schedule. I have fun, and I love meeting the fans, but it does knock me off my schedule. To the extent, I've only been doing this since last May, but to the extent I'm saying, I'm going to do fewer conventions, you know, and I haven't done that many, but it's like I really want to get my story told no matter how I publish it. So yes, those are the, we live in an age where everybody can self-publish, you know, and I intend to.